Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing, always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true-transparency-pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
And joining us in studio right now, Doug Matthews, man. He's presented by the Tennessee Highway Safety Office, reminding you, booze it and lose it. Lose your license, your freedom, your life. The Tennessee Highway Safety Office helping you arrive.
So, Doug, yesterday, Tate Martell, a quarterback transfer from Ohio State to Miami, granted immediate eligibility. From what I can tell, granted eligibility because his hardship was he wasn't going to play at Ohio State when Justin Fields, who was granted immediate eligibility to go from Georgia to Ohio State, was granted that eligibility from the NCAA. How does this change things moving forward for all transfers out there, specifically Aubrey Solomon and D'Angelo Gibbs at Tennessee?
Well, this was the case. The Tate Martell case was the case that all coaches throughout the country, NCAA coaches, were looking at. The waiver rule or process that was put in 2-3 years ago essentially was set up to be, it was supposed to be rare that it was used. And it was supposed to be for instances like maybe you, I'm just picking a school, you were at school in Utah, you were from Georgia, and your grandmother became ill or your mother became ill or whatever, you needed to get back to be able to be closer to your family. That's what it was put in place for. We have seen that kind of been expanded. We know what happened with Justin Fields going to Ohio State. That was an instance where there was racial comments made. So that was granted because of that. But the Tate Martell case, Chad, was the one that everybody was looking at because you're exactly right. Essentially what happened was Justin Fields came to Ohio State. Now, had a coaching change, had Coach Meyer leave, all that, but Coach Day was still there. And he wanted to go where he could play. Whichever side of the coin you're on that, and there's good people on both, in, both inside and outside of college athletics in general, college football in particular, whatever the case was, what this does is essentially says that the NCAA is going the route where you can transfer at any time for any reason. Now, I want to put one little caveat on this. Remember, the way that the NCAA has always worked, they pass a rule that NCAA colleges, so the associate members, it is an association, so members are members of it. They can't make it any less stringent, but they can make it stronger. So what a conference could do, let's say the Southeastern Conference comes in and says, okay, you can transfer, but you can't transfer to a school within the Southeastern Conference. That would be legal. Back in the day when they first started, NCAA first starting letting players go pro like in baseball, they could come back and play any other sport and be on scholarship and be eligible, or football, whichever one. The Southeastern Conference at that time still had a restriction that if you had signed pro, had an agent in any sport, you could not play another sport. Well, that became a disadvantage, so the Southeastern Conference finally bought into that thing about the mid-90s round in there. So that's the other part of this. But without question, what this has effectively done is said that really if you have any reason you want to leave, because there was no reason for him to leave that had anything to do with health or family or anything else. It was simply he knew he was not going to play. Again, both sides can look at this in different ways. College football coaches, I can tell you right now, don't like it. Now, the answer to your question at Tennessee is I would say Solomon without question now is there, and probably unless the Southeastern Conference gets involved, and they could. Because remember, the kid from Georgia, Gibbs youngster, is a conference school. Solomon comes from Michigan, not a conference school. I would think without a doubt he will be eligible. We'll see what happens with Gibbs.
Well, and like you said, the flip side of that is coaches are now worried about that because any time a player is unhappy with them about anything – they could transfer right down the road to a rival, possibly.
And that's why I think there will be some type of limitation put in by conferences. you know, we'll see what happens on it. Now, let me just say this. From the time I got in college coaching in 1970, I was in it 20 years, there was always things that you didn't like, and we always thought, oh, boy, that's going to ruin the sport, and it didn't. So these guys and these programs and these athletic directors and these coaches, they know how to work around these things. So whatever the ruling is, however it is applied, they'll adapt.
And we will get into some key changes in college football that I'm sure, Doug, at the time you didn't like with some of these rules changes and ways that coaches and players had to adjust to the game. That's coming up in today's history lesson, which will be in roughly 5 to 7 minutes. Before we get there, though, give us your takeaway from the five practices in Knoxville with Tennessee in spring practice and what you've heard from Knoxville.
Well, from a Tennessee perspective, obviously in the second year when you have, I think, 7 of the 10 coaches, assistant coaches were there last year. The systems are in place, knowing how to practice, where to go, what your schedule is, all of that. Now they all know that except for the early enrollees. Tennessee has 10 of those. From that standpoint, it's so much better. You know, we always heard about how a player from his freshman year to his sophomore year really takes a big jump. That's true of coaches, too. Coach Pruitt is now in his second year officially of being a head football coach. The good news from Tennessee is this. Number one, there were very few injuries that were going to keep players out. And some of that has to do with, you know, that's in the off season is when you have cleanup surgery, you know, maybe a shoulder that's been bothered that you could play with. You're a veteran player. You know, let's get that taken care of, something like that. There's a couple of those. Darren Kirkland Jr., the most he had had his surgery well before, but that's the reason they're kind of holding him out now. Good news is very few of those. There's maybe 3, 4, 5. Still don't know about Trey Smith, but again, my stance has always been if he's on the roster, I'm going to count on him playing. When he becomes off the roster, then we'll count on him not playing. I think defensively, the defensive line without question is a concern simply because there's only one player there that has had really any extensive game experience and shows he could play. That's Gooden. Getting Solomon eligible would be extremely. He is working there. He's there now working. Maybe that'll happen. On the offensive side of the ball, Tennessee, I think, has an opportunity. They like where they are over there. The hard thing and the reason I don't listen too much about what any head football coach says in spring practice is because, remember, if you're the head coach, if somebody's doing well, you like that. But guess what? If your offense is doing well, that means your defense is not, or vice versa. So, you know, that you have to kind of take all of that with a grain of salt. But I would be encouraged if I was a Tennessee fan about where this team is right now. Are they ready to go compete for the Southeastern Conference Championship? No. Should we see a big step? I am anticipating and expecting a big step of play on the field this year.
Doug Matthews with us. Coming up at 11:30 this morning, Rick Byrd will join us, head coach of the Belmont Bruins. He'll join us from Jacksonville. When we come back with Coach Matthews, we'll discuss in this week's, as we're calling it, the history lesson, the key changes on the field in college football that have really changed the game as we see it today compared to the game we saw just a few years ago. And Doug has brought with him 10 key changes that he'll point to, and he'll tell us whether or not at the time he was in favor of the way the game was turning. That's next. Midday 180 served up by Wendy's. Doug, this history lesson, we'll do this week to week as we get through the off season. I'm interested in the key changes. You've brought 10 to the table today since, I believe, 1970. Because there's a lot of changes before then that affected the game. But let's just start right up front on the offensive line. Offensive line play, what comes to mind for a key change? And tell us at the time whether or not you and the staff you were a part of thought it was good for college football.
Well, this does go back. It starts in 1970 because that's when I got into coaching. Let's remember this year is the 150th anniversary of college football, the first game that was played back in 150 years ago. 1869. So obviously there was the leather helmet and all those things. But, but this is on the field strictly. I'm going to build on this on some of my Saturday shows or in the off season, try to build on this. The offensive line ability to extend their arms in blocking. Prior to about 1980, offensive linemen had to keep their hands, their fist, in the middle of their body and could not extend them. So, in other words, they were just kind of blocking with their elbows and their head. That changed in the mid-70s, where they started allowing offensive linemen to extend their arms, as long as it didn't grab. Now, that is always part of it, where you try to hide that. So what we see now is, when you see offensive linemen able to extend their arms on pass protection, extend their arms when they're pushing someone or shoving someone, that was not the case back in about the mid-70s and prior to that. It was a holding penalty. That's one of the reasons why we've seen most of these rules that we're going to talk about were put in place not exclusively for the reason of making offenses more productive, but that was the byproduct. And this is one of them, the ability of the offensive line to extend their arms, shove, push, blocking on run game and passing game. That was a really, really key one. I was on the offensive side of the ball at the time. The offensive people were very for it. The defensive people were completely
I'm sure they were.
It. But it's been a good rule over the years, no doubt.
What did you think when they decided to move the hashes?
That was the big deal from a defensive standpoint. This does not sound like much, but prior to right around 1990, the hash mark was 17 and about 6/10 yards from the sideline. All right? Completely unlike pro football. When you had it there, what teams would do is, we had an old rule on defense with, you know, you got 11 defensive players. You never put more than 5 into the boundary. You always got more to the field because you had 2/3 of the field the other way. They moved that to 20 yards. Now, that's only 2.25 yards basically different. But if you look at it, it's about, what, 7 feet, a little bit more than 7 feet. That made a big difference in making defenses balance up. Now, we see that in pro football all the time because they're even further from the sideline.
Yes.
College is now closer to that, but they're further. And there was at one point where they just wanted to have one hash mark run right down the middle of the field and always move the ball back to the middle of the field. They didn't do it primarily because they were concerned about wearing out the middle of the field. How many times have we seen and down here at Nissan Stadium where they've had to, during the season, replant.
Resod, yeah.
Resod on that, and that's only 10 ball games. So that was a big one also. Really, really affected, again, offensive football. Now you're seeing more runs into the boundary. We used to always, on defense, try to force them running in the boundary because you got old Sammy Sideline over there. And Sammy Sideline is the best tackler there's ever been. Step on that line, and you're out of bounds.
The 12th man for you.
The 12th man, exactly. So, obviously, that is another offensive rule defensive coaches did not like.
You also have on your list the ability for the defense to advance a fumble. When did that change?
That changed in right around 1980. I might be off one side or the other. Maybe even after 1980, where if a fumble hit the ground, only the offense could advance it. We used to.
Why was that a rule?
I don't know, because it certainly wasn't a rule in pro football, but it for some reason it was a rule. All of our drills, as a matter of fact, when I was a defensive coach, you never ever scooped the ball up and ran with it. You worked on kind of sliding your body under it and recovering from
curling underneath it.
Yeah, because you could not advance it. Curl underneath it, curl up in a little ball because you know you're going to get a helmet on you from some way to knock that ball out of there. That changed. That was a big difference. Just think of the excitement we see now in scooping up fumbles on sacks and things like that. The defensive scores. That was it was designed to get more offense, but it was defensive offense, if you will, being able to score on the defensive side of the ball.
It's amazing hearing some of these things and thinking about so many people never knew football, obviously, without these
right
rule changes, but to think about going back in time and watching the game.
If we played a game today with these rules.
Right.
Yeah.
If you went back to the original rules of football as it was created without all of these changes that have happened, what that game would look like today.
Like the 40-second play clock.
40-second play clock. Why did that come in? Because it used to be that whenever the referee set the ball in play, all right, he with his hand, you had 25 seconds. Well, It came, the guy that really changed this rule in the Southeastern Conference was Jimmy Harper. We used to call him Quick Draw McGraw because he would have that ball, that clock started well, before they got the ball snapped almost. So it was just to kind of even things out. Some referees would take 5, 6, 10 seconds. Some would take 2 or 3 or 4.
You didn't know.
You did not know. Now it's pretty simple. It's just like the NFL. You got 40 seconds from the time that whistle blows until the next play has to be snapped.
One, Chad, going back to what you just said, playing a game underneath the old rules, there was a time where you could not block downfield if a pass was thrown behind the line of scrimmage.
On screen passes, that's exactly right. It was a penalty if the ball was thrown, if you were ever downfield blocking. Still is if the ball's being thrown past the line of scrimmage. But now what we're seeing with screen passes, that's where these RPOs have really, that'll be another rule we'll be talking about in the future. That has really changed college football in a way that is probably good. But any pass thrown behind the line of scrimmage, you can be downfield blocking. Now, difference in pro ball, that's one of the differences. You cannot be down the field in pro football. But if you throw any pass behind the line of scrimmage, and remember that if you throw the ball forward behind the line of scrimmage, one of the things that I always used to still laugh about is if you send a little guy in motion and you're back there and the quarterback and you toss the ball in front of him, if the ball hits the ground, if he didn't catch it,
incomplete.
It's an incomplete pass. If he catches it and runs a 98 yards with it, a quarterback gets credit for a touchdown pass or however long the yardage is. That was a big change too. Again, behind the line of scrimmage now, any pass is completed or even thrown behind the line of scrimmage, you can be blocking downfield.
Do you think there's going to be another change? You kind of hinted at this with the RPOs now and that gray area of how coaches and teams can utilize that rule to where
they're
going to cut back on that, where guys are getting out down the field a little bit too early.
Yeah, now they are allowing now on the RPO, that's any ball that's a run pass option that's thrown, because the offensive line, a run is called. They are blocking a run. You know, so if they're downfield, it's not their fault. They don't know. You know, they got to anticipate it's going to be a run. Now they'll let you go to the depth of the linebackers up to about 3 or 4 yards. That you see screaming about this all the time. It's very hard to judge because the guy that has to do it is one of two people. It either has to be the umpire, and he's looking for holding is what he's looking for primarily, and hands to the face, things like that, or the linesman. And once they are looking at it, they're looking to see if they have a responsibility in pass interference calls. They're watching a particular receiver. You don't see it called very much. You see defensive coaches screaming about it.
Yep.
It has been my experience that if you have a defensive coach screaming and an offensive coach screaming, they usually listen to the offensive coach, but hey, that might just be me reading it a different way.
Yeah, that's coming from a defensive coach saying that too.
Right.
Doug exactly. Matthews giving us our weekly history lesson, key changes on the field in college football since 1970. You have on your list relaxing crowd noise.
This is one of the biggest. Up until about late 80s, mid 80s, and I've been in many of these games, if you were the home team and crowd noise prevented the offense from checking off or it got too loud, all that quarterback had to do was back out. And the referee would call a timeout. The announcer would have to say, if there's more crowd noise, if it keeps doing this, we're going to charge a timeout to the team. And if it happens again, it's going to be a delay of game penalty. That's how it used to be. Now, my gosh, you see coaches, players, everybody wants more crowd noise. That was as early as the late 80s when crowd noise, I can remember many games playing in Knoxville. Just imagine a UT Alabama game in Knoxville, and the ball is down on the goal line. Well, and it's down on
backed up,
and it's down on where the crowd can really get into it in that bowl stadium.
Yeah,
that's changed now. Now they don't even think about it anymore. That was a penalty many times during those years. We'd have never got to a penalty called. Officials were hesitant to do that. But they did take the timeout away from me after the first warning.
A huge advantage, I would imagine, is at the time, the offense having the ability to substitute. The defense couldn't have the time to match the substitution. As a defensive coach, what was your reaction when they finally changed
this? Well, it was a great rule. It should be. I mean, anybody should be for that. I mean,
right.
And what they've done is now, if the defense even with the fast-paced offense, if the offense substitutes, then the defense, you'll see the umpire moving there. They won't let snap the ball until the defense has about 3 to 5 seconds to decide if they want to send in a player. Just imagine, I can recall very many times where we did it when I was on offense, and on the defense, it happened when I was on defense. You would run three receivers on and run three more off, or maybe have two tight ends come in, and then they'd line up and snap the ball real quickly. Nothing you could do about it. That's changed, and now, if the offense substitutes, the defense has the right to substitute. That was a big change, and that's a big plus for the defense.
Missed field goals used to be just get the ball on the 20.
20-yard line, if you'd kick a 50-yard field goal, which would be on the 40-yard line, and it's from the snap, in the NFL it goes to where the hold is. In the college, it's where the snap comes from. But if you'd snap it from the 40, so you're kicking a 50, roughly 57-yard field goal, the holder is somewhere between 6 to 7 yards deep, depending on how high he gets the ball up. It would go to the 20-yard line if it was outside the 20. Now it goes to where the ball was snapped, unless it's inside the 20. If you kick a ball from the 10-yard line, roughly an extra point, it still goes to the 20. But if it's kicking outside the 20, it goes to where the ball was snapped.
Doug, final two things most recently that fans will be able to align with here. Replay and coaches' challenges. Where do you come down on that?
I love it. Now it is how far do we go with it, but without question, things that should be reviewed, scoring plays, fourth down, ball spots, things like that. The targeting rule, I know we'll talk about the player safety issue next, but the targeting rule, all of those things have been a big plus. Now, what's the downside? The downside is they use it too much. I was at the SEC tournament, the Tennessee-Kentucky game. There must have been at least 10 minutes during that game where officials were over there looking at to see if there was a flagrant or an elbow or whatever. Yeah. So that's the downside. But from a coaching perspective, you don't care if a game lasts 6 hours or 2 hours. You want to get it right.
And you also want to keep the game as safe as possible. That's where in the direction that the game has turned recently over the last couple of seasons. I think we're all in favor of that.
Player safety rules, targeting, blocking below the waist, quarterback being able to slide now without getting hit, other things. But those are good rules, big rules. And the major changes that's happened there, John, is this. Coaches now have learned how to teach tackling, teach going through a receiver without using the crown of their head or without hitting the player with in the head or above the shoulder. Now, it doesn't always happen, but more often than not, it's because of a player ducking, a receiver coming across the middle, something like that. I think they're looking at doing some things on that, but the player safety issue was huge, and that emanates from the NFL. The NFL started all this a decade or so ago, and it's been a great change in football everywhere. That is filtered all the way down into youth football.
We are just getting started when it comes to the history lessons of the offseason with Doug Matthews. Next week, next Wednesday, Doug and Midday 180, we're going to take a deep dive into the shoe and apparel companies and how they have changed and now own college basketball.
Let me just give one stat. I'm going to say what school it is. You can look this up if you want to. There is one school out there with one clothing and shoe provider that has a 15-year contract with that shoe provider and apparel provider for $280 million, which includes $9 million in cash every single year.
Doug, we can't wait for next week. We'll be listening this weekend to the shows.
See you next week.
Titans fans, mark your calendars for Thursday, April 18th. John McClain presents In the Evening with Amy Adams Strunk. Join Team Hutton 104.5 for an exclusive night with the controlling owner of your Tennessee Titans 1 week before the NFL draft. Thursday, April 18th at the Bell Tower on 4th Avenue. All proceeds benefit the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. John McClain presents An Evening with Amy Adams Strunk. Tickets are available now at 104.5thezone.com.